in the warlock Malcolm Fade and raised him as a brother to you. He repaid their kindness with abject treachery. He stole the black volume of the dead from the Cornwall Institute, and you helped him.
Where is Malcolm?
Annabelle's voice was shaking, but also clear and firm.
Why isn't he here? I refuse to be questioned without him.
How attached you are to your warlock despoiler, sneered the Inquisitor.
Livy gasped. Annabelle looked furious.
She had Livy's stubborn set to her jaw, Kit thought, but there was a little of Ty and the rest in her, too. Julian's haughtiness, Drew's look of easy hurt, the thoughtful cast of Ty's mouth and eyes.
So will it disappoint you, then, to hear that he is gone?
Gone?
Annabelle repeated blankly.
Disappeared from his cell in the Silent City overnight. Abandon you to our tender mercies.
Annabelle clasped her hands tightly in her lap.
That can't be true, she said. Where is he? What have you done with him?
We have done nothing with him. I would be happy to testify to such under the grip of the mortal sword, said the Inquisitor. In fact, what we want from you now, and we will release you afterward, is Fade's location. Now, why would we want to know that unless he truly had escaped?
Annabelle was shaking her head wildly, her dark hair whipping across her face.
He wouldn't leave me, she whispered. He wouldn't.
The truth is better faced, Annabelle, said the Inquisitor. He used you to gain access to the Cornwall Institute, to thieve from it. Once he had what he wanted, he vanished with it, leaving you alone to take the brunt of our wrath.
He wanted it for our protection, her voice trembled. It was so we could begin a new life together, where we would be safe, safe from the law, safe from you.
The Black Volume does not contain spells of safety or protection, said the Inquisitor. The only way it could be of help to you would be if you traded it to someone powerful. Who was Fade's powerful ally, Annabelle?
She shook her head, her chin set stubbornly. Behind her, someone else was coming into the room, a stern-faced woman, carrying what looked like a bundle of black cloth. She sent a shiver up Kit's spine.
I will tell you nothing, not even if you use the sword.
Indeed. We cannot believe what you say under the sword, said the Inquisitor. Malcolm has so tainted you.
Tainted?
Annabelle echoed in horror.
As if I am filth now?
You were filth from the time you first touched him, and now we do not know how he has changed you. You may well have some protection from our instruments of justice, some charm we do not know of. So we must do this as mundanes do it.
The woman with the stern face had arrived at the Inquisitor's side. She passed him the black bundle. He unrolled it, revealing a variety of sharp instruments, knives and razors and awls. Some of them had blades already stained with rusty red.
"Tell us, who has that book now? And the pain stops," said the Inquisitor, lifting up a razor.
Annabelle began to scream. Mercifully, the image went dark. Livy was pale. Ty was leaning forward, his arms clasping his body tightly. Kit wanted to reach out, wanted to put his hands on Ty, wanted to tell him it would be all right. Communicated in a way that startled him.
"There is more," said Shade. "A different scene. Look."
The image on the wall shifted. They were still inside the same auditorium, but it was night, and the windows were dark. The place was lit with torches that burned white gold. They could see the Inquisitor's face now, where before they had been only able to see the edges of his dark clothes and his hands. He wasn't nearly as old as Kit had thought, a youngish man with dark hair. The room was empty except for him and a group of other men of varying ages. There were no women. The other men weren't wearing robes, but Regency-era clothes, buckskin trousers and short buttoned jackets. Several had sideburns as well, and a few had neat, trimmed beards. They all looked agitated.
Felix Blackthorne, said the Inquisitor, drawling a bit. Your daughter, Annabel, was chosen to become an Iron Sister. She was sent to you for a final farewell, but I hear now from the ladies of the Adamant Citadel that she never arrived. Have you any idea of her whereabouts?
A man with brown hair streaked with gray frowned. Kit stared at him in some fascination. Here was a living ancestor of Ty and Livy, Julian and Mark. His face was broad and bore the marks of a bad temper.
If you suggest I'm hiding my daughter, I am not, he said. She fouled herself with a touch of a warlock, and she is no longer part of our family.
My uncle speaks the truth, said another of the men, this one younger. Annabel is dead to us all.
What a vivid image, said the Inquisitor.
Don't mind me if I find it more than an image.
The younger man flinched. Felix Blackthorne didn't change expression.
You would not mind a trial by mortal sword, would you, Felix? Said the Inquisitor, just to ensure that you truly do not know where your daughter is.
I sent her back to us, tortured and half mad, snapped the younger Blackthorne. Do not tell us now you care about her fate.
She was no more hurt than many shadow hunters might be in battle, said the Inquisitor.
But death is another thing entirely, and the Iron Sisters are asking.
Might I speak? Said another of the men. He had dark hair and an aristocratic look. The Inquisitor nodded.
Since Annabel Blackthorne went to join the Iron Sisters, he said, Malcolm Fade has become a true ally to the Nephilim. One of those rare warlocks we can count on our side, and who is indispensable in a battle.
Your point, Herondale.
If he does not think his lady love left him, shall we say, voluntarily, or if he learns of any harm that came to her, I think it unlikely he will continue to be such a valuable asset to us.
The ladies of the Adamant Citadel do not leave their island to truck in gossip, said another man, narrow-faced as a ferret. If the discussion of the fate of unfortunate Annabel ends here, then it ends. After all, perhaps she ran away on the road, or perhaps she fell victim to a demon or a highwayman on the way to the Citadel. We may never know.
The Inquisitor tapped his fingers on the arm of his chair. He was looking at Felix Blackthorne, his eyes hooded. It was impossible for Kit to tell what he might be thinking. Finally, he said,
You're damnably clever, Felix, bringing your friends into this. You know I can't punish you all without chaos. And you're right about Fade. There's been a demon uprising near the Scholomance, and we need him.
He flung his hands up.
Very well. We'll never discuss this again.
A look of relief passed over Felix Blackthorne's face, mixed with an odd bitterness.
Thank you, he said. Thank you, Inquisitor Dearborn.
The vision narrowed to a pinpoint of black and vanished. For a moment Kit sat still. He heard Livy and Ty speaking in rapid voices, and Shade answering, Yes, the vision was a real memory. No, there was no way of identifying whose it might be. It was probably 200 years old. They were clearly excited about the mention of an Inquisitor Dearborn, but Kit's brain had snagged on one word like a piece of cloth on a hook. Herondale. One of those horrible men had been his ancestor. Herondales and Dearborns and Blackthorns together had been complicit in covering up the torture and murder of a young woman whose only crime had been to love a warlock. It had been one thing to think he was related to Jace, who seemed to be universally adored and good at everything. Everyone had spoken of Herondales to him as though they were royalty, world-saving royalty. He remembered Arthur's words.
What kind of Herondale will you be? William or Tobias? Stephen or Jace? Beautiful, bitter, or both?
Rook!
The front of the tent shook.
Kit Rook! Come out of there! Right now!
The chatter inside the tent stopped. Kit blinked. He wasn't Kit Rook. He was Christopher Herondale. He staggered to his feet. Livy and Ty leapt up after him, Ty pausing only to pocket the Aletheia crystal.
Kit, don't!
Livy started, reaching for him, but Kit had already shoved his way out of the tent. Someone was calling his real name, or maybe it wasn't his real name, but it was a part of him that he couldn't deny. He stumbled into the lane outside. Barnabas Hale stood in front of him, his arms crossed over his chest, his scaled white skin gleaming sickly in the torchlight. Behind him loomed a group of werewolves, big, muscular men and women in black leather and spiked bracelets. More than one sported a pair of brass knuckles.
"So, little rook," Barnabas said, his snake's tongue flickering as he grinned. "What's this I hear about you, pretending to be here on business for me?"
Chapter 19 The Grey Woods.
"I told you to stay away from the shadow market, Rook," said Barnabas. "Is there a reason you didn't listen? Lack of respect for me? Or just a lack of respect for downworlders overall?"
A crowd had begun to gather, a curious mixture of sneering vampires, grinning werewolves, and wary-looking warlocks.
"You told me to stay out of the Los Angeles market," said Kit. "Not every shadow market in the world. You don't have that power and reach, Hale, and it's up to the owner of this market to decide if I stay or go."
"That would be me." It was Hypatia, her smooth face expressionless.
"I thought you were the co-runner," said Kit.
"Good enough, and watch your impertinence. I don't appreciate being lied to, child, nor do I appreciate you bringing two Nephilim in here with you."
The crowd gasped. Kit winced internally. This was not going their way.
"They don't support the cold peace," he said.
"Did they vote against it?"
asked a warlock with a ring of spikes growing from around her throat. "We were 10 years old, said Livy. "We were too young."
"Children,"
hissed the man standing behind the counter of caged fairies. It was hard to tell if he said the word with surprise, contempt, or hunger.
"Oh, he didn't just bring Nephilim with him," said Barnabas with a snake-like grin. "He is one. A shadow hunter spy."
"What do we do?" Ty whispered.
They were now pressed so tightly together that Kit couldn't move his arms, pinned between Ty and Livy.
"Get your weapons," said Kit, "and get ready to figure out how to run."
To the twins' credit, neither gave so much as an intake of breath. Their hands moved quickly at the periphery of Kit's vision.
"That's a lie," he said. "My father is Johnny Rook."
"And your mother?" said the deep voice of Shade behind them. A crowd had gathered behind them, too. They couldn't run that way.
"I don't know," said Kit between his teeth.
To his surprise, Hypatia raised her eyebrows as if she knew something he didn't.
"And it doesn't matter. We didn't come here to harm you or spy on you. We needed a warlock's help."
"But Nephilim have their own pet warlocks," said Barnabas. "Those willing to betray downworld as they grub for money in the pockets of the clave. Though after what all of you did to Malcolm..."
"Malcolm?"
Hypatia stood up straight.
"These are Blackthorns, the ones responsible for his death?"
"He only died halfway," Ty said. "He came back as a sort of sea demon for a while. He's dead now, obviously," he added, as if realizing he had somehow put his foot in it.
"This is why Sherlock lets Watson do the talking," Kit said to him in a hissing whisper.
"Holmes never lets Watson do the talking," Ty snapped. "Watson is backup."
"I'm not backup," said Kit, and drew a knife from his pocket. He heard the werewolves laugh, mocking the dagger's puny dimensions, but it didn't bother him.
"Like I said," he told them, "we came here to peacefully speak to a warlock and leave. I've grown up in shadow markets. I bear them no ill will. And neither do my companions. But if you attack us, we will fight back. And then there will be others, other Nephilim, who come to avenge us. And for what? What good will it do?"
"The boy is right," said Shade. "War like this benefits no one."
Barnabas waved him away. His eyes had a fanatical gleam to them.
"But setting an example does," he said. "Let the Nephilim know what it is like to find the crumpled bodies of your children dead on your doorstep, and for there to be no restitution and no justice."
"Don't do this," Livy began.
"Finish them,"
said Barnabas, and his pack of werewolves,
as well as a few of the onlookers, sprang toward them. Outside the cottage, the lights of Polperro gleamed like stars against the dark hillsides. The sweep of the sea was audible, the soft sound of the ocean rising and falling, the lullaby of the world. It had certainly worked on Emma. Despite Julian's best efforts with the tea, she had fallen asleep in front of the fireplace. Malcolm's diary opened beside her, her body curled like a cat's. She had been reading out loud to him from the diary before she'd fallen asleep. From the very beginning, when Malcolm had been found alone, a confused child who couldn't remember his parents and had no idea what a warlock was, the Blackthorns had taken him in, as far as Julian could tell, because they thought a warlock might be useful to them, a warlock they could control and compel. They had explained to him his true nature, and none too gently at that. Of all the family, only Annabel had shown kindness to Malcolm. They had explored the cliffs and caves of Cornwall together as children, and she had shown him how they could exchange messages secretly, using a raven as a carrier. Malcolm wrote lyrically of the seaside, its changes and tempests, and lyrically of Annabel, even when he did not know his own feelings. He loved her quick wit and her strong nature. He loved her protectiveness. He wrote of how she had defended him angrily to her cousins, and over time he began to marvel at not just the beauty of her heart. His pen skipped and stuttered as he wrote of her soft skin, the shape of her hands and mouth, the times when her hair came out of its plaits and floated around her like a cloud of shadow. Julian had almost been glad when Emma's voice had trailed off and she'd lain down. "Just to rest her eyes," she said, and fallen almost instantly asleep. He had never thought he would sympathize with Malcolm or think of the two of them as alike, but Malcolm's words could have been the story of the ruination of his own heart. "Sometimes," Malcolm had written, "someone you have known all your life becomes no longer familiar to you, but strange in a marvelous way, as if you have discovered a beach you have been visiting all your life, is not made of sand, but of diamonds, and they blind you with their beauty. Annabel, you have taken my life, as dull as the edge of an unused blade. You have taken it apart and put it back together in a shape so strange and marvelous, I can only wonder." There was a loud thud, a sound as if a bird had flown into the glass of one of the windows. Julian sat up straight, reaching for the dagger he'd placed on the low table next to the sofa. The thud came again, louder. Julian rose to his feet. Something moved outside the window, a flash of something white. It was gone. And then there was another thud, something thrown against the glass, like a child throwing pebbles at a friend's window to get their attention. Julian glanced at Emma. She had rolled onto her back, her eyes closed, her chest rising and falling in a regular rhythm. Her mouth was slightly open, her cheeks flushed. He went to the door and turned the knob slowly, trying to prevent it from squeaking. It opened, and he stepped out into the night. It was cool and dark, the moon dangling over the water like a pearl on the end of a chain. Around the house was uneven ground that fell away almost sheerly on one side to the ocean. The surface of the water was darkly transparent, the shape of rocks visible through it, as if Julian was looking through black glass. "Julian," said a voice. "Julian Blackthorne." He turned. The house was behind him. Ahead of him was Peak Rock, the tip of the cliff, and dark grass growing out of gaps between the gray stones. He raised his hand, the witchlight runestone in it. Light rayed out, illuminating the girl standing in front of him. It was as if she'd stepped out of his own drawing. Dark hair, straight as a pin. An oval face like a sad Madonna, framed by the hood of an enormous cloak. Beneath the cloak he could see thin, pale ankles and cracked shoes. "Annabel," he said. The knife flew from Kit's hand. It shot across the distance between him and the approaching mob,
and drove straight into Barnabas Hale's shoulder. The snake-scaled warlock staggered backward and fell, yelling in pain.
"Kit!"
Livy said in amazement. He could tell she wasn't sure he'd done the right thing, but he'd never forgotten an Emerson quote that was a favorite of his father's. "When you strike at a king, you must kill him." One warlock was more powerful than a pack of werewolves, and Barnabas was their leader. Two reasons to take him out of the fight, but there was no more time to think about that because the downworlders were on them.
"Umbriel!"
shouted Livy. A blazing blade shot from her hand. She was a whirl of motion, her saber training making her fast and graceful. She spun in a deadly circle, her hair whipping around her. She was a gorgeous blur of light and dark, and arcs of blood followed her blade. Ty, wielding a short sword, had backed up against the pillar of a stall, which was clever because the stall owner was shouting at the downworlders to get back, even as they advanced.
"Oi, get away!"
yelled the stall owner, and her wares began to fly through the air, bottles of tinctures splattering against the surprised faces of werewolves and vampires. Some of the substances seemed corrosive. At least one werewolf fell back with a yell, clutching a sizzling face. Ty smiled, and despite everything that was happening, it made Kit want to smile too. He filed it away as a memory to revisit later, considering that right now a massive werewolf with shoulders like flying buttresses was careening toward him. He reached out and yanked a pole free of Shade's tent, causing the whole structure to tilt. Kit swung out with a pole. It wasn't the hardest metal, but it was flexible like a massive whip. He heard the crunch of bone against skin as it slammed the leaping werewolf directly in the sternum. With a grunt of agony, the lycanthrope went sailing past Kit's head. Kit's body thrummed with excitement. Maybe they could do it. Maybe the three of them could fight their way out of this. Maybe that was what it meant to have heaven in your blood. Livy screamed. Kit knocked a vampire out of his way with a vicious whack of the pole and spun to see what had happened. One of the bottles flying through the air had smashed against her side. It was clearly an acidic substance. It was burning through the material of her clothes, and though her hand was clamped against the wound, Kit could see blood between her fingers. She was still slashing out with her other hand, but the downworlders, like sharks smelling blood, had turned away from Ty and Kit and were moving toward her. She hit out, spearing too, but without being able to properly shield her body, her circle of protection was shrinking. A vampire stepped nearer, licking his lips. Kit began to run toward her. Ty was ahead of him, using his short sword to hack his way through the crowd. Blood was pattering down on the ground at Livy's feet. Kit's heart tensed with panic. She slumped just as Ty reached her, and the two of them slumped down on the ground, Livy in her brother's arms. Umbriel clattered from her hand. Kit staggered toward the two of them. He threw his pole aside, hitting several werewolves, and snatched up Livy's serif blade. Ty had put down the short sword. He was holding his sister, who was unconscious, her hair spilling across his shoulders and chest. He had a steely out and was tracing a healing rune on her skin, though his hand was shaking and the rune was uneven. Kit held up the blazing sword. The light of it made the downworlders cringe back slightly, but he knew it wasn't enough. They would press on and tear him apart, and then they would tear apart Livy and Ty. He saw Barnabas, his suit soaked in blood, leaning on the arm of a bodyguard. His eyes, fixed on Kit, were filled with hate. There would be no mercy here. A wolf leapt toward Kit. He raised Umbriel, swung it, and connected with nothing. The wolf had tumbled to the ground as if shoved by an unseen hand. There was a blast of wind. Kit's gold hair blew across his face. He pushed it back with a hand stained red. The tents were rattling. More jars and bottles smashed. Blue lightning crackled, and a fork of it stabbed into the ground just in front of Barnabas.
"I see," said a silky voice, "that I seem to have arrived here just in time." Walking toward them was a tall man with short, black, spiked hair. He was clearly a warlock. His eyes were cat's eyes, with slit pupils, green and gold. He wore a charcoal trench coat, dramatically lined with red, that swept out behind him when he walked.
Magnus Bane, said Barnabas with clear loathing. The ultimate traitor.
Not my favorite nickname, Magnus said, gently wiggling his fingers in Barnabas's direction. I prefer Our Lord and Master, or maybe unambiguously the Hottest. Barnabas shrank back.
These three Nephilim broke into the market under false pretenses.
Did they break the accords? Barnabas snarled.
One of them stabbed me.
Which one? Magnus asked. Barnabas pointed to Kit.
Dreadful business, Magnus said. His left hand was down by his side. Surreptitiously, he gave Kit a thumbs up.
Was that before or after you attacked them?
After, Kit said.
One of Barnabas's bodyguards started toward him. He jabbed out with his blade. This time, the lightning that forked from Magnus's hand snapped like a downed electrical wire between their feet.
Stop, he said. You have no authority here, Bane, said Barnabas.
Actually, I do, said Magnus. As the warlock representative to the Council of Shadowhunters, I have a great deal of authority. I imagine you know that.
Oh, we know entirely how enthralled to Shadowhunters you are.
Barnabas was so furious, saliva flew when he spoke.
Especially the Lightwoods.
Magnus raised a lazy eyebrow. Is this about my boyfriend? Jealous, Barnabas? Kit cleared his throat. Mr. Bane, he said. He'd heard of Magnus Bane. Everyone had. He was probably the most famous warlock in the world. His boyfriend Alec helped head up the Downworlder Shadowhunter Alliance, along with Maya Roberts and Lily Chen. Livy lost a lot of blood. Ty's using a healing rune, but... Magnus's face darkened with real anger.
She's 15 years old. She's a child, he snarled. How dare you all?
Going to report us to the council, Magnus? Said Hypatia, speaking for the first time.
She hadn't joined in the melee. She was leaning against the side of a stall, eyeing Magnus up and down. Shade seemed to have vanished. Kit had no idea where he'd gone.
It seems to me we have two choices, said Magnus. You fight me, and you will not win, believe me, because I am very angry, and I am older than any of you. And then I tell the council. Or you let me walk away with these Nephilim children. We don't fight, and I don't report you to the council. Thoughts?
I pick number two, said the woman who'd thrown her bottles at the werewolves.
She's right, Barnabas, said Hypatia. Step back. Barnabas's face was working. He turned abruptly on his heel and strode away, followed by his bodyguards. The other downworlders began to shuffle away, disappearing into the crowd, shoulders hunched. Kit dropped down on his knees next to Ty, who had barely moved. His eyes were darting back and forth, his lips almost white. He looked as if he was in shock.
Ty, Kit said hesitantly, and put a hand on the other boy's arm. Ty.
Ty shook him off almost without seeming to register who he was. His arms were around Livy's, fingers pressed to her wrist. Kit realized he was taking her pulse. It was clear she was alive. Kit could see the rise and fall of her chest, but Ty kept his fingers on her wrist regardless, as if the pulse of her heartbeat steadied him. Tiberius. It was Magnus kneeling down, heedless of the blood and mud spattering his expensive-looking coat. He didn't reach out or try to touch Ty, just spoke in a low voice. Tiberius, I know you can hear me. You have to help me get Livy to the Institute. I can take care of her there. Ty looked up. He wasn't crying, but the gray in his eyes had darkened to a searing charcoal. He looked stunned.
She'll be all right, he said.
She'll be fine. Magnus's voice was firm. Kit reached out to help Tiberius lift Livy, and this time Ty let him do it. As they stood up, Magnus was already creating a portal, a whirl of blue and green and rose colors, rising up against the shadows of the tents and stalls of the market. Ty turned suddenly to Kit.
Can you take her? He said. Carry Livy.
Kit nodded in astonishment. For Ty to let him carry his twin was a sign of trust that shocked him. He lifted Livy in his arms, the scent of blood and magic in his nose. "Come on," Magnus called. The portal was wide open now. Kit could see the shape of the London Institute through it. Ty didn't turn. He had slammed his headphones down over his ears and was running through the empty lane of the market. His shoulders were hunched, as if he were warding off blows that came from all sides, but his hands were steady when he reached the stall at the end, the one with the caged fairies. He began seizing the cages, yanking them open one by one. The pixies and nixies and hobgoblins inside poured out, yelping with joy at their freedom.
You, stop that!
Shouted the stall owner, running back to prevent further destruction, but it was already too late. Ty flung the last cage toward him, and it burst open, releasing a furious, clawing hobgoblin who fastened his teeth into his former captor's shoulder.
Ty!
Kit called, and Ty ran back toward the open portal. Knowing Ty was behind him, Kit stepped into it, holding Livy tight, and let the whirlwind take him. Annabelle came toward him silently, her cracked shoes making no sounds on the rock. Julian couldn't move. He was rooted to the spot with disbelief. He knew she was alive. He'd watched her kill Malcolm, but somehow he'd never imagined her as so tangible and distinct, so human. She seemed like someone he might meet anywhere, in a movie theater, at the Institute, at the beach. He wondered where she'd gotten the clothing from. The cloak didn't seem like something you'd find hanging on a washing line, and he doubted she had any money. The high rocks threw their shadows down as she came closer to him, pushing her hood back.
"How did you find this place?" she demanded. "This house."
He held up his hands and she stopped, only a few feet from him. The night wind picked up strands of her hair and they seemed to dance.
"The Piskies told me where you were," she said. "Once they were Malcolm's friends, and still they hold affection for me."
Was she serious? Julian couldn't tell.
"You should not be here," she said. "You should not be looking for me."
"I have no desire to hurt or harm you," Julian said. He wondered if he moved closer to her, would he be able to grab her? Though the idea of using physical force to try to get the Black Volume sickened him, he realized he hadn't imagined how he was going to get it away from her. Finding her had been too much of a priority. "But I saw you kill Malcolm."
"I remember this place." 200 years passed," she said as if he hadn't spoken.
Her accent was British, but there was an oddness to it, a sound Julian had never heard before.
"It looked much the same, though there were fewer houses and more ships in the harbor."
She turned back to look at the cottage.
"Malcolm built that house himself, with his own magic."
"Why didn't you come inside?" Julian said. "Why did you wait for me out here?"
"I am barred," she said. "Malcolm's blood is on my hands. I cannot enter his home."
She turned to face Julian.
"How could you have seen me kill him?"
The moon had come out from behind a cloud. It lit the night up brilliantly, framing the ragged edges of the clouds with light. "I watched Malcolm raise you," Julian said, "in the scrying glass of the Seely Queen. She wanted me to see it."
"But why would the Queen want such a thing?"
Her lips parted in realization.
"Ah, to make you want to follow me. To make you want the Black Volume of the Dead and all its power."
She reached into the cloak and drew out the book. It was black, a dense sort of black that seemed to gather shadows into itself. It was tied closed with a leather strap. The words stamped onto its cover had long faded away.
"I remember nothing of my death," Annabelle said softly, as Julian stared at the book in her hands. "Not how it was done, nor the time after when I lay beneath the earth, or when Malcolm learned of my death and disturbed my bones. I only discovered later that Malcolm had spent many years trying to raise me from the dead, but during that time, none of the spells he cast worked. My body rotted and I did not wake.
She turned the book over in her hands. It was the Unseelie King who told him that the black volume was the key. The Unseelie King who gave him the rhyme and the spell. And it was the King who told Malcolm when Sebastian Morgenstern's attack on the Institute would come, when it would be empty. All the King asked for in return was that Malcolm worked for him on spells that would weaken the Nephilim.
Julian's mind raced. Malcolm hadn't mentioned the Unseelie King's part in all this when he told them his version of the story to the Blackthorns, but that was hardly surprising. The King was far more powerful than Malcolm, and the warlock would have been reluctant to invoke his name.
In the Unseelie lands, our powers are useless, said Julian. Seraph blades don't work there, or witchlight or runes.
Malcolm's doing, she said. As it is in his own lands, so the King wishes it to be all over the world, and in Idris, shadow hunters made powerless. He would take Alicante and rule from it. Shadow hunters would become the hunted.
I need the black volume, Annabel, Julian said, to stop the King, to stop all this.
She only stared at him. 5 years ago, she said, Malcolm spilled Shadow Hunter blood, trying to raise me. Emma's parents, Julian thought. It woke my mind, but not my body, Annabel said. The spell had half worked. I was in agony, you understand? Half alive and trapped beneath the earth. I screamed my pain in silence. Malcolm could not hear me. I could not move. He thought me insensible on hearing, yet he spoke to me nonetheless.
5 years, Julian thought. For 5 years she had been trapped in the Convergence Tomb, conscious but unable to be heard, unable to speak or scream or move.
Julian shuddered.
His voice filtered down into my tomb. He read me that poem over and over. It was many and many a year ago.
Her gaze was bleak.
He betrayed me while I lived, and again when I was dead. Death is a gift, you understand, the passing beyond pain and sorrow. He denied me that.
I'm sorry, Julian said. The moon had started to sink in the sky. He wondered how late it was.
Sorry, she echoed dismissively, as if the word had no meaning for her. There will be a war, she said, between fairy and shadow hunters. But that is not my concern. My concern is that you promise to no longer try to obtain the black volume. Let it alone, Julian Blackthorn.
He exhaled. He would have lied in a moment and promised, but he suspected a promise to someone like Annabel would hold a terrifying weight.
I can't, he said. We need the black volume. I cannot tell you why, but I swear it will be kept safe and out of the hands of the King.
I have told you what the book did to me, she said, and for the first time she seemed animated, her cheeks flushed. It has no use but evil use. You should not want it.
I won't use it for evil, Julian said. That much was true, he thought.
It cannot be used for anything else, she said. It destroys families, people.
My family will be destroyed if I don't have the book. Annabel paused.
Oh, she said, and then more gently. But think of what will be destroyed with this book out there. In the world, so much more. There are higher causes.
Not to me, said Julian. The world can burn if my family lives, he thought, and was about to say it when the cottage door flew open. Emma stood in the doorway. She was shoving her feet into unlaced boots, Cortana in her hand. Her hair was rumpled over her shoulders, but her grip on the sword was unwavering. Her gaze sought out Julian, then found Annabel. She started, stared incredulously. He saw her mouth shape Annabel's name as Annabel threw her hood up over her head and bolted. Julian started after her, Emma only a second behind him, but Annabelle was shockingly fast. She flew across the grass and heather-strewn slope to the edge of the cliff. With a last glance back, she flung herself into the air.
Annabelle!
Julian raced to the cliff edge, Emma at his side. He stared down into the water hundreds of feet below, untroubled by even a ripple. Annabelle had vanished. They exploded back into the Institute, appearing in the library. It was like being dropped from a great height, and Kit staggered and fell against the table, clawing at Livy so he wouldn't drop her. Ty had fallen to his knees and was righting himself. Kit glanced at Livy's face. It was gray, with an eerie, yellowish tinge. Magnus, he gasped. The warlock, who had landed with the ease of long practice, spun around, instantly assessing the situation. Calm down, he said. Everything's fine. And he started to take Livy from Kit's grasp. Kit let her go with relief. Someone was going to take care of this. Magnus Bane was going to take care of this. He wouldn't let Livy die. It took Kit a moment to notice that there was already someone standing in the library, someone he didn't know, who moved toward Magnus just as the warlock eased Livy down onto the long table. It was a young man about Jace's age, with straight dark hair that looked as if he had slept on it and not bothered to brush it. He wore a washed-out sweater and jeans. He glared at Magnus. "You woke up the kids," he said. "Alec, we have kind of an emergency here," said Magnus. So this was Alec Lightwood. Somehow Kit had expected him to look older. "Small children who are awake are also an emergency," said Alec. "I'm just saying." "All right, move the furniture back," Magnus said to Ty and Kit. "I need some working space." He glanced sideways at Alec as the two younger boys moved chairs and small bookcases out of the way. "So where are the kids?" Magnus was stripping off his coat. Alec held out his hand and caught the coat as Magnus tossed it to him, a practiced move that suggested he was used to the gesture. "I left them with a nice girl named Christina. She said she likes children."
"You just left our children with strangers?"
"Everyone else was asleep," said Alec. "Besides, she knows lullabies. In Spanish. Rafe is in love." He glanced over at Kit again. "By the angel, it's uncanny," he said in a sudden burst, as if he couldn't help it. Kit felt unnerved.
"What's uncanny?"
"He means you look like Jace," said Magnus. "Jace Herondale."
"My parabatai," said Alec, with love and pride.
"I know Jace," said Kit. He was looking at Ty, who was struggling to move a chair. It wasn't that it was too heavy for him, but that his hands were opening and closing at his sides, making his gestures unusually clumsy and uncoordinated. "He came out to the L.A. Institute after they found out who I was."
"The legendary Lost Herondale," said Magnus. "You know, I was starting to think that was a rumor Katarina made up, like the Loch Ness Monster or the Bermuda Triangle."
"Katarina made up the Bermuda Triangle?" said Alec.
"Don't be ridiculous, Alexander. That was Ragnar."
Magnus touched Livy's arm lightly. She cried out. Ty dropped the chair he'd been struggling with and took a ragged breath.
"You're hurting her," he said. "Don't."
His voice was quiet, but in it Kit could hear steel and see the boy who'd held him at knife point at his father's house. Magnus leaned his hands on the table.
"I'll try not to, Tiberius," he said. "But I may have to cause her pain to heal her."
Ty seemed about to answer, just as the door flew open and Mark burst in. He caught sight of Livy and blanched.
"Livy? Livia?"
He tried to start forward, but Alec caught him by his arm. For all Alec's slenderness, he was deceptively strong. He held Mark back while blue fire sparked from Magnus's hand as he passed it down Livy's side. The sleeve of her jacket and shirt seemed to melt away, revealing a long, ugly cut, seeping yellow fluid. Mark sucked in a breath.
"What's going on?"
"Fight at the Shadow Market," Magnus said briefly.
Livia was cut with a piece of glass with an orias root on it, very poisonous but curable.
He moved his fingers over Livy's arm. As he did, a bluish light seemed to glow under her skin, as if it were pulsing from the inside out.
"The shadow market?" Mark demanded. "What the hell was Livy doing at the shadow market?"
Nobody answered. Kit felt as if he were shrinking inward.
"What's going on?"
Ty demanded. His hands were still opening at his sides, as if he were trying to shake something off his skin. His shoulders rolled back. It was as if his worry and agitation were expressing themselves through a silent music that made his nerves and muscles dance.
"Is that blue light normal?"
Mark said something to Alec, and Alec nodded. He released the other boy's arm, and Mark came around the table to put his hand on Ty's shoulder. Ty leaned into him, though he didn't stop moving.
"Magnus is the best there is," Alec said. "Healing magic is his specialty."
Alec's voice was gentle, the voice of someone who wasn't quieting his tone to keep someone calm, but who actually empathized.
"Magnus cured me once," he added. "It was a demon poison. I shouldn't have lived, but it did.
You can trust him."
Livy gave a sudden gasp.
Ty put his hand to his arm, his fingers clenching. Then her body relaxed. Color began to come back to her face, her cheeks turning from yellowish gray to pink. Ty, too, relaxed visibly.
"That's the poison gone," said Magnus, matter-of-factly.
"Now we have to work on the blood loss and the cut."
"There are runes for both those things," said Ty. "I can put them on her."
But Magnus was shaking his head.
"Better not to use them. Runes draw some of their strength from the bearer," he said.
"If she had a parabatai, we could try pulling strength from them, but she doesn't, does she?"
Ty didn't say anything. His face had gone still and completely white.
"She doesn't," Kit said, realizing Ty wasn't going to say anything.
"That's all right. She'll be fine," Magnus reassured them. "Might as well move her to the bedroom, though. No reason for her to sleep on a table."
"I'll help you take her," Mark said. "Ty, why don't you come with us?"
"Alec, can you go to the infirmary?" Magnus said as Mark went to lift his sister into his arms.
Poor Livy, Kit thought. She would hate to be dragged around like a sack of potatoes.
"You'll know what I need."
Alec nodded.
"Take Kit with you," said Magnus. "You'll want help carrying everything."
Kit found himself not minding the idea of making conversation with Alec. Alec had a comforting sort of presence, quiet and contained. As he and Alec headed out of the room, Kit glanced back once at Ty. Kit had never had siblings, never had a mother, had only had Johnny, his father who had died. And he didn't think he'd ever look the way Ty looked now, as if the possibility of something happening to Livy was enough to break him inside. Maybe there was something wrong with him, Kit thought as he followed Alec into the hallway. Maybe he didn't have the right kind of feelings. He'd never wondered that much about his mother, who she was. Wouldn't someone who knew how to feel properly wonder that?
"So, you met Jace," said Alec, scuffing his shoes along the carpet as they went. "What do you think?"
"Of Jace?" Kit was puzzled. He didn't know why anyone would solicit his opinion on the head of the New York Institute.
"Just making small talk."
Alec had an odd half-smile, as if he were keeping a number of thoughts to himself. They passed through a door marked infirmary into a large room filled with old-fashioned single-metal beds. Alec went behind a counter and started rummaging.
"Jace isn't much like you," Kit said. There was a weird dark patch of wall across from him, as if paint had smeared up and across it in almost the shape of a tree.
"That's an understatement." Alec piled bandages on the countertop. "But it doesn't matter. Parabatai don't need to be like each other. They just need to complement each other, to work well together." Kit thought of Jace, all shining gold and confidence, and Alec, all steady, quiet ease.
"And you and Jace complement each other?"
"I remember when I met him," Alec said. He'd found two boxes and was dumping bandages into one, jars of powder into another. "He walked out of a portal from Idris. He was skinny, and he had bruises, and he had these big eyes.
He was arrogant, too. He and Isabel used to fight. He smiled at the memory. But to me, everything about him said, love me, because nobody ever has. It was all over him, like fingerprints. He was worried about meeting you, Halleck added. He's not used to having living blood relatives. He cared what you thought. He wanted you to like him. He glanced over at Kit. Here, take a box. Kit's head was swimming. He thought of Jace, swaggering and amused and proud. But Alex spoke of Jace as if he saw him as a vulnerable child, someone who needed love because he'd never gotten it. I'm no one, though, he said, taking the box full of bandages. Why would he care what I think? I don't matter. I'm nothing. You matter to Shadow Hunters, said Alec. You're a Herondale. That'll never be nothing. Holding Rafe in her arms, Christina sang softly. He was small for 5 years old, and his rest was fitful. He squirmed and sighed in his sleep, his small brown fingers twisted into a lock of his dark hair. He reminded her a little of her own small cousins, always wanting another hug, another sweet, another song before sleep. Max, on the other hand, slept like a rock, a dark blue rock, with adorable big navy eyes and a gap-toothed grin. When Christina, Mark, and Kieran had run down to find Alec, Magnus, and their two children in the Institute parlor, Evelyn had been there, fussing about warlocks in her house and the undesirability of being blue. Christina hoped most adult Shadow Hunters didn't react to Max like that. It would be awfully traumatic for the poor little mite. It seemed that Alec and Magnus had returned from a trip to find Diana's messages asking them for help. They had portaled to the London Institute immediately. On hearing about the binding spell from Mark and Christina, Magnus had headed for the local shadow market to scout out a spell book he hoped might break the enchantment. Rafe and Max, upon being left in a strange house with only one parent, had wailed. Sleep, Alec had said glumly to Rafe, carrying him into a spare room. Adorno. Christina giggled. That means ornament, she said, not sleep. Alec sighed. I'm still learning Spanish. Magnus is the one who speaks it. Christina smiled at Raphael, who was sniffling. She'd always sung her little cousins to sleep, just as her mother had with her. Maybe Rafe would like that. Oh, Rafaelito, she said to him. Oh, little Raphael, baby. Ya es hora de ir a dormir. ¿Te gustaría que te cante una canción? He nodded vigorously. Sí. Christina spent some time teaching Alec all the lullabies she knew while she held Max and she sat with Rafe. Not long after that, Magnus had portaled back, and there had been a great deal of thumping and bumping from the library, and Alec had raced off, but Christina had decided to stay where she was unless she was called on, because the ways of warlocks were mysterious and their charming boyfriends, too. Besides, it was good to have something as harmless as a child to distract her from her anxiety. She was sure, relatively sure, that the binding spell could be undone. But it bothered her just the same. What if it couldn't? She and Mark would be miserable forever, tied by a bond they didn't want. And where would they go? What if he wanted to return to Fairy? She couldn't possibly go with him. Thoughts of Diego nagged at her, too. She thought she would come back from Fairy to a message from him, but there'd been nothing. Could someone disappear out of your life like that, twice? She sighed and leaned down to stroke Rafe's hair, singing softly. Arro mi niño, arro mi sol, arro pedazo de mi corazón. Hushabye, my baby, hushabye, my son, hushabye, oh peace of my heart. Alec had come in while she was singing and was sitting on the bed beside Max, leaning against the wall. I've heard that song before. It was Magnus, standing in the doorway. He looked tired, his cat's eyes heavily lidded. I can't remember who was singing it. He came over and bent down to take Rafe from her. He lifted the boy in his arms, and for a moment Rafe's head lolled against his neck. Christina wondered if this had ever happened before, a shadow hunter with a warlock for a parent.
Sol solicito, caliénteme un poquito, por hoy, por mañana, por toda la semana, Magnus sang.
Christina looked at him in surprise. He had a nice singing voice, though she didn't know the melody. Sun, little sun, warm me a little for the noon, for the dawning, for all the week long. Are you all right, Magnus? Alex said.
Fine. And Livy's fine. Healing.
Should be back to normal tomorrow. Magnus rolled his shoulders back, stretching his muscles.
Livy?
Christina sat up in alarm.
What happened to Livy?
Alec and Magnus exchanged a look. You didn't tell her? Magnus said in a low voice.
I didn't want to upset the kids, said Alec. And I thought you could reassure her better.
Christina scrambled to her feet.
Is Livy hurt? Does Mark know?
She was reassured by both Magnus and Alec that Livy was fine and that, yes, Mark did know, but she was already halfway out the door. She bolted down the hallway toward Mark's room. Her wrist was throbbing and aching. She had been ignoring it, but it flared up now as she worried. Was it pain Mark was feeling, transmitted through the connection between them, the way parabatai sometimes feel each other's agony? Or was the binding spell getting worse, more intense? His door was half open, light spilling out from beneath it. She found him awake inside, lying on his bed. She could see the deep indentation of the binding rune, like a bracelet around his left wrist.
Christina, he sat up. Are you all right?
I'm not the one who was hurt, she said. Alec and Magnus told me about Livy.
He drew his legs up, making room for her to sit on the blanket beside him. A sudden reduction of pain in her wrist made her feel a little dizzy. He told her what they had done, Kit, Livy, and Ty, about the crystal they'd found at Blackthorn Hall, their visit to the Shadow Market, and how Livy had been injured.
I cannot help but think, he finished, that if Julian had been here, if he hadn't left me in charge, none of it would have happened.
Julian's the one who said they could go to Blackthorn Hall. And most of us are running missions at 15. It's not your fault they disobeyed.
I didn't tell them not to go to the Shadow Market, he said, shivering a little.
He pulled the patchwork blanket up around his shoulders, giving him the look of a sad harlequin.
You didn't tell them not to stab each other with knives either, because they know that, she said tartly.
The market is off limits, forbidden. Although, don't be too hard on Kit. The Shadow Market is the world he knows.
I don't know how to take care of them, he said.
How do I tell them to obey rules when none of us do? We went to Ferry, a much greater breakage of the law than a visit to the Shadow Market.
Maybe you should all try taking care of each other, she said.
He smiled.
You're awfully wise.
Is Kieran all right? She said.
Still awake, I think, he said.
He wanders around the Institute at night. He hasn't rested well since we came here. Too much cold iron, I think. Too much city.
The neck of his T-shirt was frayed and loose. She could see where the scars on his back started, the marks of old injuries, the memory of knives. The patchwork blanket had begun to slip down his shoulder. Almost absently, Christina reached to pull it up. Her hand brushed along Mark's neck, along the bare skin where his throat met the cotton of his shirt. His skin was hot. He leaned into her. She could smell the pine of forests. His face was close enough to hers that she could make out the changing colors in the irises of his eyes. The rise and fall of her own breath seemed to lift her toward him.
"Can you sleep here tonight?" he said hoarsely. "It will hurt less for both of us."
His inhuman eyes glittered for a moment, and she thought of what Emma had said to her, that when she looked at him sometimes she saw wildness and freedom and the unending roads of the sky.
"I can't," she whispered. "Christina."
He rose up to his knees. It was too cloudy outside for any moonlight or starlight, but Christina could still see him, his light hair in tangles, his eyes fixed on her. He was too close, too tangible.
She knew if he touched her, she'd crumble. She wasn't even sure what that would mean, only that the idea of such total dissolution frightened her, and that she could see Kieran when she looked at Mark, like a shadow always beside him. She slid off the bed.